Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by one of my favorite recurring guests, Jamie Monroe. Jamie, how's it going, my man?
Going great, Terry. Always love talking lacrosse with you.
And never a better time of year to do it. We are basically cresting the conference seasons in college lacrosse, getting ready for postseason action, and in high school lacrosse. It's the thick of it, depending on where in the country you are. I believe that the latest starting states like Minnesota and New Hampshire, they've got some games under their belts. The earliest ending states like South Carolina and Texas, they still have games to go. So this is it. This is like peak lacrosse season, as peak as you get. And there's no better time of year, right?
So true. I mean, just inundated. And I have happen to love watching men's, women's, high school, boys, girls, box. There's a lot of big time lacrosse going on.
And that's why now is the perfect time for you to jump on the podcast. So the hook is that I attended the event for all of your GM3 athletes in Delray right before Christmas. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what I observed and learned about some of the fundamental beliefs that you bring to coaching, you bring to the sport of lacrosse. We're going to throw out and bat around terms like ecological dynamics, constraints-led approach, and principles-based. It's always principles-based offense. We'll talk about whether or not there's principles-based defense as well.
There is.
Let's start topical. Let's just, you know, we're beyond the midpoint. And so the midpoint represents, I think, the natural opportunity to look back at your preseason expectations and contrast what has happened, the new evidence against that. So I can make an argument that it's like, oh, we're too late to do that. But with that being said, I am such a believer in the best way to understand how somebody is thinking about what they're observing is to understand what they expected. So just briefly characterize, and to your point, we can talk about women's division one, men's division one, we can talk about boys and girls high school, but wherever you want to start, what were your thoughts and expectations heading into 2026?
Well, if I were to start on the men's lacrosse side, my expectations are also sort of with my hopes, and sure. I was really excited for Princeton. I work with a bunch of athletes there and have also become good friends with Jim Mitchell and done a lot of Zoom calls and watched a lot of film. And I love the way that he coaches and the way they run their principles-based offense. And I was really hoping that they were going to be able to be good enough defensively because I figured they were going to be pretty darn good offensively. And sure enough, you know, they've really, other than, you know, a couple of aberrations, particularly in their first game against Penn State, I think they've got shorties, they've got a goalie in there, and they've got some new pulls in there that have been making some amazing plays, and they mostly play man, but they've got, I don't know if you've noticed, they've got a pretty interesting zone that they've played that I actually haven't seen that zone before. I haven't asked Mitch or any of those guys about it, but it's like a different zone setup. As far as the way that they align their players. And it's interesting. And I actually saw Brown run that on Saturday when I was at the Brown Dartmouth game. But so, yeah, I was really, really excited for Princeton. I was very interested to see how Notre Dame was going to do. I figured that they would be very, very good defensively because they always are. And they've got some returning horses back there, but they obviously like lost a lot offensively over the last couple of years. And I think they're proving that they can win a grind it out style of play. Didn't realize Richmond was going to be as dominant as they've been, although I did go to the Richmond Notre Dame game where they had a debacle in the first quarter, but then were able to reel it in and play good lacrosse for three quarters. Very interested to see how Cornell was going to be able to bounce with the loss of CJ Kirst, and they've been very consistent and good. Maybe better than I thought they would be, honestly. Those are a couple of the themes and thoughts that I had. Carolina maybe has been better than I thought they were going to be. But I'm not sure I'm a total believer in them on offense. They can definitely win faceoffs or if they can win faceoffs, they didn't against Notre Dame, that they'll be able to be really, really good. Maryland has been a little bit of a head scratcher just because we're so used to them being so good all the time, but it looks like they're maybe hitting their stride. And I think everybody was questioning whether Duke was going to be good enough, and I think they've got a lot of proving to do. They probably have to win their next two games to be able to make an NCAA tournament, make the ACC tournament. So I think that's going to be really interesting too. So those are a couple of my thoughts.
Yeah, no, that was really rich. And I do want to start with Princeton because I think relative to some of the other teams that you mentioned, they have flown a little bit below the radar, beneath the radar. And I wanted to start with that point that you made about their first game against Penn State, because obviously you come at this from the standpoint of having been a Division I head coach and then, you know, having built one of, if not the biggest club organization, and now, you know, doing a little bit more one-on-one connection with high-performing athletes. And I'm curious as to how you think about the nature of a first game, particularly around when it's your first game and you're playing a team that it's not their first game. And one of the things that BU head coach Ryan Poley pointed out to me as well around that time was the delta between the second and third game as well. So effectively, you know, the way he framed it was, obviously, you don't really know who you are before your first game. And then between your first and second game, you have a better sense of who you are. But at the same time, you don't know what the anomalies and aberrations in your first game were. So it's only after your second game when you can really get a baseline for who you were. And that was Penn State's third game. And they were playing Princeton in their first game. I think the players in their post-game comments after their subsequent games were very direct in pointing to maybe that they were reading a little bit too much of their own headlines, which I found to be impressive, right? And, you know, just to be that honest, assuming that it's true, right? It certainly wouldn't be the type of thing that you would say if it weren't true. So just in general, like, how do you regard and part of the reason it's so germane is because when you look at their NCAA tournament resume, if you can properly contextualize what that loss to Penn State means, as Penn State then, you know, has garnered a few, well, three non-top 20 losses, it can be really useful in terms of effectively deciding, you know, does Princeton warrant a number one seed in the NCAA tournament? Because if they didn't lose to Penn State, or if that game gets properly contextualized, that argument becomes a lot easier to make.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, if the season ended now, you know, it might be there's so much season left that we can't even, you know, we can't even really say. But I would say Penn State has been a little bit of a Jekyll and Hyde team. They've played incredibly well and won some big games, and they've lost some bad ones. And that's just like a weird thing that happens to teams sometimes. But I do think, you know, if I had the choice between being scouted versus playing my third game against a team that hasn't, I'd always prefer to play my third game. I think it's a bigger advantage in every way. I mean, it's just, you're even getting in game shape, you know, like game shape means you're playing games and you're just like, you know, there's a level of adrenaline that kicks in that makes you a little bit more gassed when, you know, when you're not having played games, no matter how hard you decide you want to. I'm not a big believer in running guys to get them in shape before games, because I think no matter what, you're always kind of gassed in your first game and you got to get into game shape. And I'm a bigger believer in being fresh and healthy and rested. But I think it's a big advantage from that perspective. And like you said, knowing who you are, knowing the things, you know, figuring out sometimes in the preseason and in the fall, kids look awesome and they don't perform as well in games. And it's just the way it goes. And you got to sort of figure that out. And then obviously there's things that you might think you're doing really well against yourself, or in scrimmages that don't count that you thought you were going to be better at that you're not, and you just make adjustments. And, you know, obviously I think that the headlines part that you brought up, I mean, Princeton has huge expectations and they should. They're returning a lot of really good players. And, you know, they just, in the first part of that game, they just sort of struggled and couldn't dig themselves out of it. But I think they've proven to be good. And they made some adjustments too, you know, with Chad Palumbo, my guy, back on attack, and moving Bonanno to the midfield. It seemed like a knee-jerk reaction at the time. But Palumbo's been great down there, and Bonanno's been hurt, which has been sad. He's another guy that I've known. I actually went to college with his dad, and I played high school and college lacrosse together, Brian Bonanno.
Yeah.
And Pete is a special player and is only going to make them better when he gets back. But I think everybody makes adjustments to sort of figure it out. And I guess the answer to the question is the Ivy Leagues are at a disadvantage to have to like always kick it off against teams that have played two or three games.
Yeah. Let's transition to the women's side, and then we can come back. I actually do want to use Princeton as a little bit of a jumping off point for the broader part of this conversation that we, you know, want to have. But obviously, you're incredibly close to the Northwestern women's program. The framing of the original question, if I were to answer it myself, my expectation for the men's season was that it was going to be wide open. I feel like that has been something that we've revisited multiple times as the year has gone along. But what was interesting was that in the earliest days of the season, the women's side, which we did not expect to be as wide open, proved to be even more wide open than the men's side with some of these early season upsets. You know, programs in the top five losing to programs outside of the top 25, which is not something that we have traditionally seen ever in women's lacrosse. And I think speaks to the growth, development, and evolution of the relationship between the supply of talented players and where they go, and then how much better they get when they get on campus. And again, that's probably a little bit of a theme that we're going to discuss. But that is not the case at Northwestern. This is obviously a perennial national championship contender and a team coming off of a national championship game appearance. Your daughter is a member of the team, and you're very close with the staff. Through that lens, what were your thoughts on the 2026 season, and how do you feel like things have unfolded for the Wildcats?
Yeah, well, obviously, everybody was picking Carolina. You know, they hadn't lost a game for the entire 2025 season, and they didn't lose. They lost their first game in March against when they were hosting the Wildcats, actually, in a huge overtime upset win for Northwestern. But you know, I think everybody kind of thought that there was going to be like, you know, like it was last year. There was like pretty much three teams that were like way out, you know, ahead of everybody else. And games were just not close. I mean, I can't even tell you how many running clock games I've watched, you know, where Northwestern's up by 10 sometime in the third quarter, and it's a running clock in women's lacrosse when that happens. And that hasn't happened much this year. And I think it is because things are just getting way much more competitive. Although it did happen yesterday in our game against Rutgers. But I think there are a bunch of teams that actually could now win a national championship in women's lacrosse. And I don't think we would have thought that last year. I think everybody thought it was Carolina and maybe Northwestern and BC, which it kind of turned into being. But I mean, I think there's probably five or six teams. You know, I think Stanford is excellent. I think Hopkins, very capable. Maryland, very capable. BC probably a little bit too young, but they usually kind of gain a little bit of momentum. Obviously Northwestern is very capable. North Carolina's defending champs and still loaded. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be exciting. And with the Final Four at Northwestern, I'm just praying that the Cats can make it there.
So you mentioned that you were at the Notre Dame Richmond game, and I think that is a good platform for setting the expectations for what the Final Four is going to look like at the Lake Show. I mean, one of the coolest opportunities, not the program, but really any women's college program has had. What do you expect the Final Four at Northwestern to be like?
Well, I could just tell you that the facility, the way the stadium is set up on the lake, built up for football, because they're, you know, just so listeners can know, Northwestern is investing, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, I think like a billion. Yeah.
A billion, yeah. Into a new football stadium on campus. And in the meantime, they built up the women's lacrosse stadium into having, you know, seating, I don't even know how many, but it probably seats like 30 or 40,000, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it's fill up, but it did for football games. And it's just an incredible setting on the lake, really, really professional looking, even though it's like temporary stuff. It looks really cool. So to be able to have that as a venue is incredible. And obviously, like, you know, I've been able to go to the last four Final Fours, Washington Northwestern. They won a championship at 23 and lost in the championship at 24 and 25. And you know, the Cary, North Carolina was like amazing experience, but not even close to as cool of a setup as what Northwestern will be. And Gillette, you know, I'm a Pats fan, so that was pretty special for me to be there. But yeah, it's going to be, you know, it's incredible lacrosse, and the venue's unbelievable. And Evanston's such a cool town with great restaurants. It's going to be fun.
Nice. Let's transition to talk about Jan 3 and Delray, and you know, kind of just talk a little shop, I guess, is probably the best way to describe it. So, for folks unacquainted, just describe what Jan 3 is and what the Delray event represents.
Yeah, basically, what we do is we work with athletes, individually, in the sense that we, you know, we have individual athletes that we work with, but we always work with them in groups, and we use a methodology called the constraint sled approach, which is underpinned by the most contemporary skill acquisition theory in the world called ecological dynamics. And I've always been a total nerd when it comes to learning lacrosse and learning about sports and learning about coaching. And I would say that this journey in learning more about this approach has been incredibly exciting and effective and fun. I would say for any coach, but also for any parent, you parents, you're the gatekeepers of your kids' time. It's worth it to know what the science is saying as far as how humans move and how we learn, and that this ecological approach, while there's parts of it that are obvious, there's parts of it that are already happening. Every coach is using constraints in one way, shape, or form. But it's really important to understand this because it makes a massive difference. This is not sports science. This isn't just like my opinion. You can get a PhD in ecological psychology and dynamical systems theory, or in ecological dynamics, and people are studying this, and there's empirical evidence now of studies done on endless things to understand human movement, and that's what we're talking about. So we apply this to our athletes and try to help them become better lacrosse players through training and watching film.
So one of the ways to best understand what something is to understand what it isn't. How similar is the study of ecological dynamics, or how much does it bump up against biomechanics and physiology?
Well, so I can't say that I'm an expert in biomechanics or physiology. So I think biomechanics exist. But the question is, the way you frame this up, what is an ecological approach or the constraints-led approach? What is it not? It's not a focus on mechanics. It is a focus on the interaction between the athlete and his or her environment. Basically, what's happening in the moment. It's like the mechanics of driving a car and going in a parking lot and getting really good at the mechanics of turning the wheel and pressing the gas and anything you want to do without the context of weather, of what car you're in, of traffic, of, you know, like of somebody else not following the rules of the road that you have to react to, of being in a hurry, of not being in a hurry, or of having the distraction of your friends in the car or whatever, or texting. You know, these are the things that are the environment that we're in. And so when you sort of take it to the example of driving, like, usually, you know, the backseat driver is not seeing the road the same way the driver is. And therefore they're like, oh, well, then they're, you know, like my wife does not love driving with me because she doesn't see the exact same opportunities that I see. Whereas I might not like sitting in the seat with somebody else because I'm seeing opportunities that I would really wish you would take because we're in a hurry here and I'd like to be able to get to the airport. And when you're in an Uber that goes slowly and there's opportunities to like get there, you know, I'm looking for those. And the recognition of these opportunities is what the game is. So whether it's using, you know, have you ever like taking a left, seeing a, you're at, you want to take a left turn. There's a lot of traffic. Someone's taking a left turn in front of you and you basically tuck right behind them and essentially use them as a seal so that you're not going to get hit by the oncoming traffic. Okay. That's the same read that you would have in a game where you recognize that somebody's sealing space for you and you take that space, right? And your ability to see these things as players is what IQ really is. And it happens in everyday life. This ecological approach is not limited to sports. It's like literally happening all day, every single day. And the constraints that are natural constraints, whether it's the speed of the car we're driving or the how big of a hurry we're in or whatever it is, the weather are going to affect us the same way that interacting constraints occur in games.
Have you used this driving analogy before? Because you definitely had that teed up pretty fast and it worked through all the way to the end pretty well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm always trying to think of how people can understand what I'm talking about because it happens all day long in everything that we're doing.
And I think that that's one of the most useful takeaways that I had from being around this, which is a cynic. And we've had these types of conversations before, and you've heard me start from the cynical approach, could say this is just putting terminology on something that everybody already does. And I think that warrants a fair response in two ways. Number one, it's like, yeah, that's actually like a decent explanation. But second, and more importantly, the assumption that everybody already does it or already does it the way in which the science suggests it should be done is not true. That's a faulty assumption that leads to bad outcomes. So the reason I wanted to frame what is ecological dynamics through what it isn't, specifically in the context of biomechanics and physiology, is because I think when a lot of people think about, to your point about sports science, they think about it in the context of muscles and bones. But ecological dynamics is thinking about in the context of neurons and synapses and mental processing. Do you agree? Is that like kind of, I mean, obviously you want to develop the physical acuity in order to do the things that your brain wants you to do, but the method is really more about visual auditory processing and evaluating opportunities and then taking advantage of them and making decisions, correct?
So I don't know if I would like articulate it that way, nor have I necessarily exactly read it that way. And look, as much as I'm a practitioner of this, but I don't have a PhD in it. So I just do my best to figure out what are they saying and how do I apply it to coaching? So I've probably got one of the better practical approaches to all this, but okay. So the dynamical systems theory, part of ecological dynamics, is all about self-organization. Okay. And so when you talk about muscles and joints and bones, your body is a complex system that self-organizes. In other words, you are not controlling thinking about all of your fingers and motions and grip and steps and how you can't do that and react at the same time. You're not going to like be driving along and all of a sudden something jumps in front. You just swerve away. You're not thinking. You're reacting. And there's not actually processing that goes on. It's actually self-organization. Now there is perception that we can anticipate. Yeah, I don't want to get too close to the car in front of me because I'm anticipating that there's like traffic and I want to give a little bit of a cushion of space between me and the next car. That you could call that processing if you want to. You can also call that perception. But when we're acting, when we're reacting, when we do the most incredible athletic things in our lives, they just happen. And they do not have to have happened countless times exactly that way before. In fact, they will never have happened countless times that way. So whether we're talking about the human body, whether we're talking about like an ecosystem, or whether we're talking about the weather, or whether we're talking about team offense, complex systems react and self-organize in the face of constraints, which is basically what this whole model is all about. You design the constraints that will allow the athletes to find the solution in the situation that they're in. So if you want somebody to learn how to read a coverage of a pick, obviously you got to give them that coverage. And so that's the part that's already always been done. Everybody does this. It's not that I didn't every coach is using constraints, whether a constraint could be the time, the space, the numbers, the coverage, the action, the scoring system. It's not that people aren't doing that. It's not that I wasn't doing it. What's different about this is, if you dive into it, is the amount of intentionality that you can use to be able to design a scenario where the athletes will figure it out. Because we can get athletes to literally do anything on command. But it's the transfer of being able to do that thing in a game that's the hard part. And so therefore, we need to design it where they have to figure out a solution, and it's going to be a different solution for you than it would be for me. One of the greatest analogies ever is, you take Jokic, Giannis, and Curry and give them the ball at the top of the key with 10 seconds left in a tie game and perfect spacing. They're going to do incredibly different things to win that game. Whereas Curry might see the space to be able to pull up and shoot. Giannis will probably get to the basket and draw a foul or get to the rim. And Jokic will like stick his body in there and reluctantly shoot it and probably look to do something deceptive to hand it off to somebody or pass. But they're all very different in the way they view the game, because they're all very different physically and everybody is different. So the key is, and what's different also, is that we're not looking for one solution or one way, one technique, one mechanic. Although there are certain mechanics that totally exist. And so the last piece that I want to throw in here that's incredibly important, that was probably the biggest thing for me, was the idea of variability. Because while every good coach understands how to use constraints, and we go back to our favorite drills because they do create the behaviors that we're hoping for, going back to those drills a lot becomes like fool's gold. It's doing a similar practice plan on a regular basis is a recipe for practicing great and playing like crap on game day, because the games are incredibly variable.
Right.
And that's what's the hard part about it. And so if you do not insert amazing amounts of variability, then you're not teeing yourself, your players up for being very adaptable. But usually coaches want to, like, they look at variability as like noise. Do it this way. Just do this. And it becomes literal handcuffs in the self-organization of the individual and of the team. And it doesn't mean that, back to your, you use these word principles. Principles exist on, you have principles for your all four phases of the game. Principles on offense, principles on transition defense, principles on defense, principles on transition offense. And these principles are the guide. And how the players execute it is going to be different for every player. We need to stick to principles like getting great shots. If we're taking crappy shots, we're going to lose. Maybe the most important principle of the game is getting to the middle and getting a good shot. And so therefore, what we try to do is use as much variability as we can, keeping the principles very consistent, while we use as many different constraints as we can to try to give these kids, try to make them more adaptable as players so that they can execute. I mean, what is lacrosse IQ but your ability to individually execute principles of play in a game? And that's what it is.
When did you start on this journey of being more academic and applying terminology to the things that you had previously things that you had previously done that you didn't want to keep doing?
Specifically, I began to rethink my view of coaching in around 2017, when I sold 3D, and I also at that time stepped down as the head boys lacrosse coach at Mountain Vista High School, where my son had been coaching, and I wanted to move on and coach my daughter and help out. And it was an opportunity for me to actually step back in life, which a lot of us don't get to do because we're so into the next thing all the time on this conveyor belt of the next season and the next thing. And I was able to reflect on what I was proud of, what I was happy with, what I wasn't satisfied with. And I would say while there were a lot of things that I was proud of, the main thing that I wasn't satisfied with was the translation of what I knew kids could do to what they actually did in games. These kids can do anything. They can do everything. And if you have the time with them, and I was pretty meticulous about having lists of, 150 things I wanted an offensive player to know how to do in terms of different dodges and shots and feeds and all kinds of moves and two-man and reads, and the deception is endless. And I was like, I could get to the point where these kids, they knew exactly what I was talking about and they could do anything, but they couldn't, it didn't, it was almost like the Wedding Crashers quote of, you know, people talk about people only use, you know, 15% of their brain. I think they only use 15% of their heart. And my analogy is you only use 15% of your repertoire. And so I began looking for a different way. And I came across a blog from a soccer guy named Raymond Verheyen. And he talked about, it is not the execution of the skill that is a hard part. It is the decision to execute that skill, which is basically what we're talking about. And then fast forward a couple of years. So I started going down this free play back to my roots of an athlete. I started going down a free play model of like, well, if I can get them to do it on their own, can they, will it translate better? It was basically like my initial theory before I knew anything about ecological dynamics, and it was working. The free play was incredible, incredibly impactful for the athletes that I was working with and my own kids. But then I came across a blog from Alex Sarama, who is really been a mentor to me. He runs the organization called Transforming Basketball. I would recommend anybody read that book, subscribe to his podcast. He's like 29, which is crazy because he's like young but brilliant and a great guy. And he's just transitioning right now from the NBA offensive coordinator position with the Cleveland Cavaliers to the WNBA, where he's taking over the new Portland franchise, and he's going full CLA in every single way with this program, and it's going to be incredibly exciting. So that's basically how I've gone. And like anybody else, I've just dialed it up and up and up and up and up and really started studying and reading as much as I could, particularly when Alex's book came out. But also practically, how do you actually do it?
Right.
How do you challenge yourself to be more variable and figure out different ways of teaching something through constraints? And I actually have a great example of one that I can share with you that's really cool. I was trying to teach in women's and men's lacrosse, but specifically in women's to start, but it's absolutely, it's just as applicable to men's. We use this constraints all the time. But I was trying to teach the third girl on a three-man side how to be the nation's outlet to be a feeder. So what is a nation's look for those listeners that don't know? Everybody knows what a pick and roll is. The dodger passes it to the picker as he or she rolls to the net. A nation's look is simply throwing it to a third player that then throws it to the roll. So it's like a two-pass pick and roll. And every time I was trying to do this, the third player was always just in the way. She was not in a dangerous position, a good angle, and she was actually jamming up the two-man game herself by trying to be a feeder. She was actually in the way. In men's lacrosse, very similar to an X guy that comes so far ball side to be the outlet that they're just actually in the way of the dodger getting underneath instead of playing sort of a hang-up type of a drift game. It's the same kind of concept of off-ball spacing and being an outlet. And so I had this idea of like, well, maybe I should get them to mirror, and then they would mirror, and then the defender was always like, on their back so that the defender was seeing the play and the mirror wasn't working. And I was like, well, they really need, if I was doing this, I'd be getting behind the defender. So I came up with a constraint, which is if you get behind your defender, you can say, look at me, and the defender has to look at you, or you can say, look at the ball, and they have to look at the ball. And so all of a sudden this constraint was teaching the players how to get into the blind spot of their defender and actually read whether they were looking at them or looking at the ball, which is pretty easy to do once you get into that spot and they like look at you. Well, they can't see the ball. They can't help. And oh, by the way, you can throw that pass because they're not seeing the ball, just like in a back shoulder pass in football where the quarterback can throw it knowing the DB can't see it, or late hands on dropping it in there. Likewise, if they're looking at the ball, they can't see their defense. They can't see their matchup. And therefore you can easily get open, similar to zone defense in football, where they're all watching you, you got to find a soft spot and you can get open pretty easily if you can read that, right? But the fact is that even though this constraint makes it a little bit too easy at first, if you get behind your defender, they literally can't see both. And your main goal in the game on offense, one of your main principles is one can't guard two. We can't allow one player to guard two. And in an all-even scenario, That's where the on-ball defender can see you and see the ball, which is why they get into a flat triangle and they turn their heads and they try to see both. And we can't let them do that. And so this idea of trying to figure out how do I get this girl to be a good position for a nation's feeder has then translated into every facet of the game. It accounts for drifts. It accounts for crease play. It accounts for how you position yourself to be a threat, which is what we're trying to teach players all the time, is like, you have to be a threat. You have to occupy, you have to get open. And all of a sudden it really comes down to, look at me, look at the ball. Do not let your player do both. Do not let them see both. And so this constraint, then I was able to take that and put it into anything we wanted. If we want to teach crease play, we can have a big little behind and 2-on-2 in front and just say, all right, defense, you can offense, you can say, look at me, look at the ball. Or I can graduate it to defense, you just have to see both, which is basically what they have to do anyway. So now the defend offensive player is constantly getting them to try to see both. And then I was like, I then added the constraint, hey, if you make your defender off ball flip their hips, you're doing a good job. See how many times you can make them flip their hips, which is they have to do as they're adjusting their flat triangle. Eventually they have to flip their hips. Otherwise they're giving up too much angle in one direction or another. And so in any case, these are just some examples of kind of how you take a challenge, what's holding this team back, how you creatively figure out a constraint for it, and then how you can essentially scale it across all different elements of the game.
One of the constraints for JM3 is that you want to coach a bunch of different athletes that don't all live in the same place. And so you utilize video a lot in order to do it. And then that's the role that this Christmas time event serves, is an opportunity to bring everybody together. So can you describe a little bit about what the experience of working with these athletes via film is, and then how it culminates in this opportunity to bring everybody together that speaks the same language and understands the utility of the vocabulary in an effort to try to really maximize the touches and reps that they get in a, you know, 2 or 3 day window?
Yeah. So if our entire model is about creating situations that players have to play in, then we have to find ways for players to train with our players. Private lessons look great, but don't work because they don't actually have any context. So what we end up doing is we have camps and hubs of training throughout the year. We have athletes in sort of the Boston and New York area where we have like weekly training going on. And then we have some national camps like in Delray Beach, Florida before Christmas. All summer long up in Rhode Island, you know, we've got, you know, probably around 50 to 70 kids showing up to train every weekday of July and then twice a week in August. And we do these sort of national sort of camps. And it was so great to have you down to check it out. It's a pretty, it's a fun camp. We've got like, you know, we probably had 15 Northwestern girls. We had like 10 Princeton guys. We have committed kids, college kids, younger kids, 29s, 30s. We don't mix all of the age groups all the time, but what we do is we train and try to create awesome opportunities for these kids to learn. We're able to unleash new constraints and fun games that we haven't tried before that the kids always love, because we're constantly, this ecological approach has just allowed me to grow and learn so much because of the variability concept and the creativity concept combination. And we film everything that we do. And so then we're able to go back and start working on all of the things that we want the kids to understand. And it's always comes back to principles of play. And on offense, like I said, it would be getting to the middle, shot selection, one can't guard two, or the bigger picture principles of vision and communication and deception, which are like actually, you know, pretty much of the glue for all of it. And so we end up having, I don't know, about 100, 120 kids or so down in Delray. We bring in coaches, some college coaches. My son Colin, who's at Jacksonville, comes down. JT Giles Harris came. The pro players that come, like Michael Sowers, who, by the way, we need to chat about because he is a full-time JM3 now and a former athlete that trained in this model and made huge improvements in his game. Kieran McArdle. When we bring down pro players, the best part is they play. I'm great with them. I want them to coach, but I really want them to play with the kids. I want the kids to get a feel for playing with Michael Sowers or Kieran McArdle or playing against or alongside of JT Giles-Harris, and then get film on them, and you can see how they are doing or not doing the exact same things. It's amazing how the conversations with any athlete, you know, whether it was with Chad Plumbo or Pete Bonanno or Michael Sowers or a typical 29, you know, attackman that I'm working with, they're all kind of the same conversations because the principles of play don't change. We all have to do the same things. It's more like, how are we going to get there and how much variability can we create? And then obviously if we can make it fun, it makes it even better. And so,
and that's kind of the natural segue to, you know, one of the things that stood out most to me and kind of ties this all the way back to the beginning of the conversation talking about Princeton. And what I think is kind of so special about the intersection of effectively like what Matt Madelon and his staff have struck, which is, you know, it is hard to be a student at Princeton. You know, I remember going through the college application process and like the adage was, it's hard to get into Harvard and it's hard to get through Princeton. And, I have heard that in truth from a lot of the folks that have, you know, experienced that. And so, at, you know, we have the Bill Tierney 90s era dynasty. And then, you know, we have this kind of resurgence program under Matt Madelon. And what strikes me is, having spent time around a lot of the guys, is how, you know, that 90s crew, like if you've met a lot of the alums, like the characters, right? You can kind of see the Princeton-ness in their, in the same way that you can kind of tell a Brown guy when you spend time with them.
Disgusting.
What I find to be so interesting about this era of Princeton guys is the combination of how normal they are. Like they're just kind of normal individuals. I wouldn't characterize them as characters in quotation marks. And then equivalently, how lax, ratty they are. And one of the things that's interesting about that is that I think what the staff has done is found a balance between the demands, the academic demands, and the pleasure release valve of lacrosse. And it's not unlike a service academy in that way, where you always hear that service academy coaches say some version of their practice has to be the best part of their day because the rest of their day is so difficult. And the thing that stands out, and I've seen this, is for as much lacrosse as they do play practicing on Class of 1952 Stadium, it sounds as if that locker room's three-by goal is as in use perpetually as any three-by goal in any college lacrosse locker room. And I think that says a lot about a lot of what this conversation entails. So I don't have a question so much as how do you react to the notion of like fun and passion while also then, you know, parlaying into the success that the program has had, you know, relative to the prior decade and what it says about what you're trying to accomplish when it comes to coaching these individuals and seeing them graduate to the next level?
Yeah, I think it's just the passion part and honestly, what the service academies are trying to do, we should all be doing. Why wouldn't lacrosse practice be the best part of the day? We can certainly make it not the best part of the day as coaches. And I'm sure I've been guilty of that, but I can tell you that like, it's crazy not to go in with that mentality. Tim McCormick at Hopkins has done an unbelievable job he makes it his goal to, and on the women's side, to make practice the best part of the day. And the beauty of this ecological approach is it allows you to do this as a coach, because playing in context is way more fun than playing on air, period. Just can't deny it. Playing is what the kids love to do. But if everything is rooted in principles of play and we can be very strict and disciplined with the principles of play, like the shots that we're going to like, require our players to take can be very hard on that, but we can be very easy on how they go about doing it. And the more variability
we have the better. Nothing gets more boring than doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over. And so this entire approach makes a difference, because we all know that around this time of year, people are beginning to turn the page, sadly, to summer. And sometimes it's even like, I'm going to get so much better this summer. I can't wait to work on my game this summer. I'm like, there's still a month left in the season. What are we talking about?
Right.
We should be trying to, like, this is like the most exciting and best time of the year. But when people get beaten down and when they start to get tired, this is what happens. And so being able to have a passion for it, trying to recruit that. I mean, I know Kelly Monty Hiller really tries to recruit a love for the game as much as she recruits anything, because, you know, look at, some kids are great at what they do, but they don't actually love it. And it may be hard to make anybody love something that they don't love. Those Princeton guys do. That's why like 9 or 10 of them showed up down in Del Rey, because, you know, Colin Burns and Chad Palumbo and Pete Bonanno and Brody Upton and Tucker Wade and Jake Vanna, these guys are, like you said, they're lax rats. They love to play and they love to get better. And they, you just watch them out there, and any new task we were giving them, they were like, all right, you guys. And they were just like getting organized and then talking about it all night. You know, they it's just, it's the best. And so I think they've really got something there, but I think it's what we all want. Right. And it's what we want for our kids is passion, because if you're passionate about something, it makes you want to work hard at it. But the work doesn't always have to be miserable. There may be things that you got to do that you don't want to do. That's life. But man, there should be a lot of really fun things that allow us to be challenged and get better, all at the same time while we're like enjoying it. And you know, I think the notion that principles-based offense or this ecological approach is just either it's nothing new, or the notion that everybody is just throwing the ball all over the place. It's not the case. Like, you're not going to win that way. But if you dive into this, you'll find that you'll get more passion out of your players, and you'll get the kind of discipline that you need.
And I think that's a nice segue into talking about Michael Sowers, because he's special for a lot of reasons. And, you know, I have always shaded more toward the physicality side of player evaluation and analysis. But one of the things about Mike that's always stood out to me, I remember when he was going through the recruiting process, the story that he effectively, you know, developed rhabdomyolysis because he just played so much lacrosse, and he went from Under Armour tryouts to U19 tryouts to XYZ, and, you know, basically just, you know, played himself to the bone. And, you know, that's not something you want to do. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that, you know, that was probably 2014, 2013, something like that. And here we are 13, 14 years later, and you get it going talking about lacrosse or giving him an opportunity to play. And the passion is burning just as bright, if not brighter, than it was back then. So obviously you're excited to bring him on at JM3. How do you describe what he means for the organization and what you hope to see out of, you know, his continually evolving role?
Well, of course, I was always a huge fan of Michael Sowers. I didn't really know him, but I knew some of his friends at Princeton. And in the fall of 2023, he reached out via text and said, "Hey, coach, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to talk across with me. I feel like I've hit a plateau in my training and I just really want to get better." And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." And, you know, basically Michael has always been like as hard of a worker and as an intentional of a worker and player and trying to be the best, but, you know, he tries to be the best at everything though. I mean, cause as good of a player as he is, he's a better guy. Like, he just tries to do the right thing. He works hard. He follows up. He's humble. He tries to be the best teammate, all of this. And it ended up being like an amazing relationship that we had for a couple of years prior to him joining full time with JM3, where I just coached him as if he was a JM3 athlete. And I wasn't in person with him as much because he was in Philly and he didn't get up to a lot of our training, although we did make it to Delray a couple times. But I was basically like, okay, we're going to work with you remotely. Go get yourself a small net, get kids together and play small net games with tennis balls. And let's start using these constraints and let's start adding to your game in the context of all of these different situations that we want you to be in, whether they're uneven situations or all even situations or two-man game situations. The amazing thing about Michael Sowers is that he was such a hard worker and he was such a reps guy. He was like wall ball every day, stick in my hand every day, cone, speed ladder, all of this footwork, legendary for his footwork. For example, he could throw and catch behind the back 100 times in a row at all different angles, throw and catch it behind the back. But yet he had never thrown a behind the back pass in a game at any level until the 2024 season. It's amazing.
It's crazy.
So that's what I was talking about. Back to my step back of this is like, why is it that players know how to do stuff, but they don't do it in games? And how can we make that happen? And so Michael started training mostly with high school kids, twice a week with tennis balls and small nets. And then twice a week, he would strap it on and go down with the Salesian AM kids, where he worked out a lot with those guys. And then he gets some college poles or get a bunch of Drexel poles to go work on his game if he wants to go live. But we started using this exact constraint sled approach. And after 9 months of training, his first season in the PLL, after starting to train this way, he averaged a point more per game. His turnovers went down. His shooting percentage went up by like 50%. We were talking about his shooting. We were like, you know, he was like, I'm disappointed with my shooting percentage. And I was like, Michael, first of all, you do take harder shots than most because you're basically almost every one of your goals is a one-on-one dodging goal against the other team's best defenseman. But I'll also note that you're almost always shooting through a check. If you can figure out how to draw a check before you shoot it, you're going to be able to shoot with your hands free. They can't check twice in a row. And so he began to start watching, you know, the way Ryder Garnsey does that coming across the up the hash or coming across the top, or the way Connor Fields drops his hands and draws checks. And honestly, a lot of players do this. And it's just an example of how we were able to target something in his game that was going to really help his shooting percentage. And it really did. Another one was his two-man game. His view of two-man game was basically run full speed, get a switch, and go one-on-one, which is fine, except for the fact that if it's 15 times a game, it's not that great. Because they're just going to – eventually, anything you do that much becomes easier to guard. And then if they slide and recover to you and pack it in, you don't really get to make that much of a play. And what he started to realize was reading the coverages, like bringing a player over a pick. If you can basically get a defender to follow you over a pick and put him on your back – you're either going to like get all the way to the net or the shorty has to step up. And if the shorty steps up, that's 2-on-1. That's a really big advantage that you're not going to get when you're dodging a shorty and they slide and peel off of you. There is no 2-on-1 there. There's a peel off. They're out there for a moment. There's two guys involved in this, but everyone's packing it in and you got to move the ball. So the upside in reads and deception have really been what Michael Sowers has gravitated to. And if you asked him his view of the game 3 years ago versus now, he would say deception is everything. And being able to read the game is what allows you to like leverage this deception. So fast forward a few years later, all Michael Sowers wants to do is be the best player he can possibly be. And he wants to try to win a gold medal in the 2028 LA Olympics. And we talked about him joining JM3, and now he's on full-time doing Zoom calls with athletes. He couldn't be more committed to learning this ecological approach for himself. He's like the best example of like, you know, I don't care if you're a 20-30 and you're a raw athlete or you're Michael Sowers and already at the time that I met him was the, by his peers, rated the number two player in the world. There's incredible upside for getting better. How do you get better if you're Michael Sowers? It's not going to be on the wall. But it could be in getting better at reading pick coverages. Now I would say what he has to get a little better at is reading when they're going under and not letting them go under so easily to meet him on the other side of a pick. Because of his speed and his ability to blast off, he just has had so much success and can make it work in so many ways. But there's just so many elements of things. And then it's like, okay, what are the drills or constraints that we can give him with a couple guys in Philly to be able to go work on, to be able to like learn these different reads. And that's what the fun of this model is we'll just figure out more in different new ways to like figure out how to like put you in situations to learn things, whether you're Michael Sowers or, you know, your average good 2029. Like Chad Palumbo was like, he was an average good, you know, 2022 when he was a sophomore. He was good, but he wasn't like, holy shit, good. He was just a good player. But man, talk about passion and talk about, well, how this small net games and pickup affected him. I remember having a conversation with Chad one time and I was like, hey, Chad, when are you going to get your behind the back license? And he's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, I mean, you know, like you almost have to have a license to be able to feed behind the back. Like certain guys are allowed to do it. It's like a license to kill with James Bond.
Right.
But you don't get that license at practice. You're going to get your license revoked if you try to like get your license at practice. You got to get your license somewhere else. And you can't get your license on the wall because everybody can do that. Everybody already knows. Everybody already does do that. You got to get your license into some kind of a free play scenario, and nothing better than small net games, which represents box across without the physicality. And all of a sudden, the kid started popping BTBs. And a year later, he had a highlight video that was like, all of a sudden, I could be like, hey, you know, send it to Mitch or send it to Sean Kerwin and be like, check this kid out.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he's obviously got an incredible aptitude for the perception, but he also had an incredible passion. And if it honestly, I think he would tell you too, it was the free play in the small net games that actually allowed him to really explore the creativity that you've been able to see in his game.
Explore the studio space. I think that's a good note to end on, Jamie, as we part ways. Any final thoughts?
No, man, just really fired up for the down the stretch of the season. Always fun to talk lax with you. Thanks for having me on. And hopefully if people want more information about this ecological approach, shoot me an email at jmonroe@jmfreesports.com or check out jmfreesports on Instagram or Twitter.
Awesome. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. We'll be back with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts later in the week.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.